and Andrews.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Alex Kleinberg. I represent the appellant in this case, EGP Investments, LLC, and I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. We're asking this Court to reverse the trial court's order dismissing EGP's complaint due to insufficient service of process. We submit the trial court committed reversible error by dismissing our complaint because the defendant personal representative, or PR, failed to prove by the requisite clear and convincing evidence standard that service upon him was defective. This is a case where the parties never engaged in any discovery. No depositions were taken, but nevertheless, the trial court granted the personal representative's motion to dismiss EGP's complaint due to insufficient service of process. Now, although we requested additional time to conduct discovery, as seen from clerk's papers at 33, and we also requested an evidentiary hearing during the July 20th, 2012 hearing on the defendant's motion to dismiss, the trial court...
How do we know that from the record, that you requested an evidentiary hearing?
Well, Your Honor, as the Court's undoubtedly aware, the defendants have suggested that that's not supported by the record, that request. Unfortunately, this hearing that was held up in Snohomish County Superior Court, it was not recorded or transcribed. And as a result, we filed the motion to submit the additional evidence, two declarations, one from Attorney Jeff Yonick, who appeared that day, one from Brian Fair, the member manager of EGP Investments. And we've put forward that additional evidence and asked this court to admit that evidence to show we did, in fact, request an evidentiary hearing. And we've only done that because, Your Honor, the other side has made an issue of this request. So, but
failure to preserve error happens all the time, and we don't typically give people a second chance to go back and provide a self-serving declaration that says, yes, I did too. I did bring it up. I mean, you can imagine the havoc that would wreak with the appellate procedure, can't you?
I can, Your Honor, but I submit
this. Why should we make an exception in your case?
Because this is not the ordinary case, Your Honor. That's why. We submit it's different. And I also submit that, if nothing else, the clerk's papers at 33 do reflect we did request additional time to conduct discovery. In all fairness, that's not highlighted in our brief, but it is there at clerk's papers 33. But, Your Honor, at the end of the day, in our view, we submit reversal is in fact warranted, because this is a case where our complaint was dismissed just based on declarations with inconsistencies that the defendant submitted, and the original declaration of service from our process server, Mario Robledo, that is good on its face. It shows service was good on its face, was never stricken. The trial court refused to strike that declaration. We submit that this court need look no further in order to reverse, given the clear and convincing standard of proof that undoubtedly applies here. But I will continue.
You make an issue of the clear and convincing standard of proof. Are you conceding then that if the standard of proof is substantial evidence that there's enough?
In this case, no, Your Honor. I would not. And the reason for that is the original declaration of service that, again, is good on its face, does show that we effectuated good service on the personal representative, abode service, by leaving a copy of the summons and complaint with the John Doe who was then resident therein. And that by itself, because that declaration was never stricken, despite the personal representative's motion to strike it,
would be
enough.
But if they come in with competent evidence that shows that the person served was not resident therein, don't you have to rebut that in some way? Because, I mean, how's the process server supposed to know?
Well, Your Honor, we submit that in cases like that, controlling case law in our states that the trial court should hold an evidentiary hearing. When you've got sharply contested facts, dueling declarations, the trial court...
Suppose the evidentiary hearing wasn't asked for and the record doesn't show that it was, and so therefore the court didn't have to hold an evidentiary hearing. What's your answer then?
First, I'd like to respond, Your Honor, by saying that regardless of whether one was requested, and we submit it was, and that the record sufficiently supports that, but even if one wasn't requested, the trial court's obligated to conduct one in a case like this where there's conflicting declarations.
And the case that says that is?
Among others, Woodruff v. Spence, Your Honor, 88 Winamp 565. That case is from 1997. In addition, I'd like to spend a moment highlighting the declarations that the personal representative did put forward. We've got declarations from Brad Domhoff and Jason Rask, who've both testified to the effect that service was no good here. Well, as we've seen, it's undisputed there are inconsistencies in these declarations and that both of these declarants changed their story. It's also undisputed that we'd submitted evidence after the hearing on the motion to dismiss that reflects that these two declarants have both been convicted of theft. And because that's a crime of moral turpitude, we'd submit that's even more reason, more basis for holding an evidentiary hearing in this case. Had the trial court done so, we would have had an opportunity to impeach the credibility of these witnesses, or at least try to do it, not just based on the past criminal convictions, but also just based on their inconsistent stories. And there are a number of inconsistencies in those declarations, as we've highlighted in our briefing.
Do you have any evidence that Brad Domhoff resided at this address?
It might be in the record, Your Honor. At this point, a citation escapes me.
I looked, and I did not see any. I mean, there's a lot of reasons that you provide as to why Brad Domhoff maybe isn't the best witness, but it seems to me that the evidence from the defendant is that Domhoff didn't live there.
Your Honor, even if that's the case, there is evidence in the record that shows a John Doe did in fact live there. This mystery person that we submit is not Brad Domhoff, who's in our view not been identified here, and that the John Doe told our process server, this is seen from Mario Robledo's declaration, Laura Mies' declaration, the process server manager, that a John Doe was in that residence where the personal representative lived. This person told the process server the personal representative lived there. That's our evidence, and we submit, if nothing else.
Laura Mies' evidence is competent. Why?
Well, for a couple of reasons, Your Honor. One, most notably, under CR.
He wasn't there.
That's correct, Your Honor.
He
but
really doesn't know anything except what people told her. Isn't that true?
I think that that's true, Your Honor, but I also believe that she can properly testify based on her company's business records because she was reviewing her records in making this affidavit. We think it's clear she's a records custodian of the process server company, but perhaps more importantly, we have the Marsh case that we cited from this court in 1999, I believe, that references CR4G and notes that when it comes to proving validity of service under CR4G, hearsay statements and declarations of service are in fact admissible.
Hearsay declarations of the process server, isn't that what the case holds? Not somebody else.
Well, that could be, Your Honor. We'd submit, though, that...
So let's just assume that we're not going to pay too much attention to Laura Mies' declaration. It doesn't add anything, really, that you've explained to me. So let's see what else you've got.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't hear that.
What else is there, then? Well, proof that Mr. Domhoff actually lived there.
Well, whether Mr. Domhoff lived there or not, in our view, really isn't relevant because we do have evidence that somebody was in there and somebody told the process server that the personal representative lived there. We'd also submit that at the end of the day, because we have the original declaration of service from Mario Robledo, which on its face reflects good service at that address, that's enough, if nothing else, to have an evidentiary hearing. All we're asking, Your Honors, to have our day in court. We urge reversal.
May it please the court, my name is Mitch Cogdill and I represent the respondent in this case. There are several things that are undisputed by the admissible evidence and the evidence that was admitted below, and that is that Eric Andrews was not ever personally served, number one. There is no evidence at all that Brad Domhoff ever lived in the house occupied and owned by Eric Andrews. The declarations of Mr. Robledo, both on 7/26/12 in support of the motion for reconsideration and on 6/1/12 in support of the original process service, do not indicate at all that he had any conversation with the so-called John Doe indicating that he had lived there. Neither of them have that in the declaration. The only place that appears is in the declaration, as Your Honor pointed out, of Laura Mies, who is not the process server. And she allegedly is relating what Roblato apparently or allegedly told her. Interestingly enough, Roblato had a chance to say that in his declaration of the 26th and didn't do that, didn't say that at all.
Didn't say what again?
That did not say that anybody he served,
that he talked to,
said that he lived there.
Claimed to live there.
That's right. And he had a chance to indicate to Meese that that was in fact the case. In fact, the only evidence before the court was that Demhoff lived at another place. Now, counsel wants to attack the credibility of the statement, but even their own investigator, in hearsay statements that we moved to strike incident to their motion for reconsideration, said that the information he got from that the person living in that residence is that Brad Demhoff moved out in June, after the date of this alleged service on May 30th. That's what they have. Now, the problem that...
Well, just to get back here, I'm sorry, to the Roblato declaration, the first one says that he left the summons and complaint at the residence with a John Doe, who is a resident therein. And if I understand what you just argued, it is that if the declaration had said with a John Doe, who told me that he was a resident therein, you would have a different case.
Maybe. But we would have a burden of showing that who the John Doe was, I think, if we knew, and that the John Doe didn't in fact live there. And we came forth and met that burden, and the appellant in this case has not shown any evidence to the contrary in their investigation as to the addresses of Brad Demhoff. Now, this brings up what they did in response to that, and it reminds me of what Sir Walter Scott said in the poem Marmion. Oh, what a tangled web we weave when we first practice to deceive. Because what they did was submit declarations in support of their motion for reconsideration on two premises. Number one, they were submitting evidence that they couldn't have discovered before, which, as I will indicate, is not so. And secondly, they weren't informed of our motion to strike because they came up with a document that had a stamped receipt on it from the process server that we retained in Wenatchee to serve this on the attorney that had a date different than that which the process server received when she actually served the process.
And I think we understand your argument with respect to the difficulties of some of those affidavits. But let me ask you about this issue of the evidentiary hearing. Counsel
yes.
just argued that under Woodruff versus Spence, the court should have perceived, sua sponte, the need to hold an evidentiary hearing in this case because of the...
I don't believe Woodruff says that. And there was never a request for an evidentiary hearing, as indicated by the record. And the thing that I think speaks louder than anything, appellant went to great lengths in its motion for reconsideration to present new information, new evidence, and not once did they say in their motion for reconsideration, and Your Honor, you should have provided an evidentiary hearing just like we requested. Not once. It's totally silent. They had multiple opportunities to verify or confirm that they had been requesting an evidentiary hearing, and none was requested. And I don't think Woodruff says that the court has an obligation on its own to conduct an evidentiary hearing if there are no material questions of fact as to, in this case, the residence of the person who was actually served with the papers. Now, that brings up the point that they have, or the facts, which I think have been created by the appellant. They now say that Mr. Roblato was shown a picture of Brad Demhoff, which he says is attached as Exhibit A to his declaration, which isn't. So we don't know what picture allegedly was shown, if any, and that that's not the person that they served. It was another John Doe, a mystery person that nobody can identify. Now, that's convenient because they had just lost the case. It was dismissed. They know that they can't show that Brad Domhoff lived in the residence, and they just confirmed that he lived someplace else because the person they talked to and the information they submit told them he moved out in June. And so now they say, that's not the guy we served. It was somebody else. Now, I guess they're asking us to submit evidence to prove a negative, and we don't have any evidence of anybody else being served because it was Brad Domhoff who, in fact, gave the pleadings to Mr. Andrews. So that is the tangled web that has been weaved in this particular case. They came up with that new theory. They had to have a reason for not submitting it previously, and one of the reasons was, hey, we didn't get the motion to strike soon enough, and here's a stamp to show it. I just think, quite honestly, it really stinks, Your Honor. And that's where we are in this particular case. The court did strike many of the statements in the declarations, statements that lack foundation. The declaration of Meese, because, of course, she wasn't the process server, and it was clearly hearsay. Hearsay statements and other declarations, including from Fair, including from Andreessen, about third parties' comments to him, and so on and so forth. But in reality, what this comes down to, after all of the layers are peeled away, Brad Domhoff was the one who was served. They have no evidence that he lived there, and their own evidence showed that he lived someplace else. And one last thing, Your Honor, we're requesting attorney's fees on appeal. We're requesting attorney's fees under TEDRA 1196-150, I believe it is. A very broad statute, Your Honor, that allows for the award of attorney's fees on any defense of an action brought in a probate by any party. And we're asking that under these circumstances because of the facts that give rise to the case. This is a clear case where this sort of thing has to be discouraged in terms of the defense by this collection company who bought this debt from Bank of America and then goes after somebody to recover more than they paid for the doggone debt. And I think that attorney's fees in this case are warranted, and we're asking that that be the case. TEDRA is broad enough, probably the only act that I can imagine that is broader than that right now is the Patriot Act. And TEDRA allows for the recovery of attorney's fees in a case like this. Thank you.
Does that turn on prevailing party only, or do we have to find misconduct?
You don't have to find misconduct. It's in the court's discretion. It's allowed on appeal. But I think we have to be the prevailing party for that to occur, Your Honor. As to this motion.
First off, Your Honors, a scene from Clerk's Papers at 33. I thought I would just read this one sentence. Plaintiff respectfully requests the court grant plaintiff's motion so that it can engage in discovery to further investigate the questionable information contained in the Domhoff declarations. I'd submit that we did, in fact, properly ask the trial court for additional time to do discovery and find out if service was good or not. As for opposing counsel's statement that we never requested an evidentiary hearing, I find it rather telling that the personal representative doesn't argue that in his brief on appeal. He doesn't actually argue they never requested one. He says, well, the record doesn't support their request, nor is there any evidence in the record that reflects we did not request an evidentiary hearing. So I do want to highlight that.
He does kind of make a good point, don't you think, when he points out that you had the opportunity, you did file a motion for reconsideration. And that would have been, would it not, the logical time to say, Your Honor, we requested an evidentiary hearing, and the result here shows why you should have granted one. And but there's nothing in the motion for reconsideration. After the hearing is already over and you're aware that the bad consequences have followed from what you're now contending was an error.
Your Honor, the part of the record that I just read to is our memorandum in support of the motion for reconsideration, filed in support of the motion for reconsideration.
Yes, that's for additional time, isn't it?
Well, yes, but we submit that...
Is additional time to conduct discovery, in your mind, the same thing as an evidentiary hearing?
I think it's very similar. What it does, it gives us an opportunity to provide evidence that supports our position so our case is not summarily dismissed without an evidentiary hearing. As seen from our brief, page 22 of our opening brief, the rationale behind requiring the clear and convincing standard of proof when dismissing a complaint for lack of personal jurisdiction is that if you don't have that, and if you let the personal representative, for instance, do what he did here, that Any greater burden of proof, such as preponderance by the evidence, would permit a defendant to obtain a dismissal simply by controverting the facts established by a plaintiff through the defendant's own affidavits and supporting materials. And that's from the Ninth Circuit data disk case, 557, 5 second, 1280. And we submit that controlling law does not permit this sort of thing to happen when the declarations, the affidavits, are sharply in dispute. And we submit that the trial court should have provided us with, if not an evidentiary hearing, more time to do discovery. And as such, we respectfully urge the court to reverse.
Thank you. That concludes our calendar for day. We will be in recess. Thank you.